The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Derek Frost for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading from the Triangle Business Journal. We start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story headline, Can Medicaid Heal Itself? As the state prepares to go from one Medicaid payer to five, a differing reality is emerging between insurers and providers. In the middle, 2.6 million North Carolinians. And the article begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with the second headline, Medicaid Transformation or Deformation. North Carolina's 2.6 million people enrolled in the Medicaid program are about to face a harsh reality, big changes with an unknown outcome. Written by Sonia Warwick. For decades, major health care providers in North Carolina have been fighting to protect the way traditional Medicaid works in order to maintain access to care for the roughly 2.6 million people enrolled in the program. We've done what we can for decades, says Stuart Smith, vice president of Duke University Health System. Healthcare providers lost that fight in September 2015 when then-Governor Pat McCrory signed House Bill 372 into law, laying the groundwork for the state's transition to managed Medicaid, which went into effect earlier this month. As North Carolina prepares to go from one Medicaid payer to five, the state and health insurers are expecting the transition to go smoothly, but healthcare providers are preparing for a different reality. I think we're in for some trouble, Smith says. How the system used to work. Before the decision to transition to managed Medicaid, North Carolina was working with a system that was both saving money and was highly praised. The Community Care of North Carolina program, which the transition will effectively dismantle, managed Medicaid through a partnership between the state and 14 nonprofit community care networks. Beneficiaries joined medical homes that coordinated their health care service through their primary care providers. A 2015 audit of the program from the Office of the State Auditor that examined data from 2003 to 2012 found the program resulted in both improved health outcomes and cost savings, including a 25% reduction in inpatient admissions and a 10.7% decline in prescription drug use. A 2011 analysis by Washington-based consulting firm Milliman found the program saved the state nearly $1 billion between 2007 and 2010. The Commonwealth Fund used the program as one of 15 case studies illustrating how to organize healthcare delivery for high performance in 2009. That resulted in providers across the state participating in the program and allowing Medicaid beneficiaries to get services virtually anywhere in the state, Smith says. That is now expected to change. A patient may get their care from a physician, but will have to get lab work done somewhere else if insurers don't like the contract rates with a particular provider, he says. Why the state made the transition and how it's going to work. One of the most important reasons for passing HB 372 for lawmakers was year-over-year budget predictability, says Dave Richard, Deputy Secretary for North Carolina Medicaid. By placing more emphasis on health outcomes through factors such as care management and the social determinants of health, Richard says the state expects to see a leveling off of cost growth in the Medicaid program. Under the new system, Medicaid beneficiaries must choose from five health plans: WellCare, UnitedHealthcare, Healthy Blue, AmeriHealth Caritas, and Carolina Complete Health, administered by private insurers. Some Medicaid beneficiaries will be exempt from managed Medicaid, including federally recognized tribal members. Others won't be transitioning to managed care right away, including those with development disabilities, traumatic brain injuries, severe mental health needs, or people who rely on long-term support and services. The health plans are expected to providers based on a capitation rather than a fee-for-service model. Capitation reimbursement pays providers a fixed amount based on overall health outcomes. Fee-for-service pays providers a fee for each service rendered. But I don't think we should expect to see any significant cost reductions in the program because inflation will happen, and it takes quite a while for these kinds of measures to actually make a significant difference in terms of the cost of the program, Richard says. The state's expenditure on Medicaid programs has been gradually increasing over time, growing by just under $1 billion from 2015 to 2019, according to data from the State Department of Health and Human Services. Despite that growth, North Carolina Medicaid has consistently finished the past seven fiscal years under budget by millions of dollars, ranging from being $45 million under budget to $243 million under. Problems with access to care. Triangle healthcare providers say the system was already working well before the state decided to make the transition, and they're afraid of what this will mean, particularly when it comes to access to care for Medicaid recipients. The reason behind that is that providers will have to secure contracts with each of the five insurers. While UNC Health and Duke Health have done that, Rick Carrico, Executive Vice President and Chief Financial Officer of WakeMed Health and Hospitals, says WakeMed has secured contracts with two and is in the process of securing two more. What we've tried to do is to ensure that we've got consistent contracting standards for WakeMed so that we can basically have an even playing field in terms of how we can develop the relationship with the plan and serve their members, Carrico says. Carrico says he's uncertain WakeMed will be able to get contracts with all five, but it's the health system's goal because it has 76% of the Medicaid inpatient admissions annually in Wake County. Not every provider across the state is likely to get a contract with all five insurers, which is going to have dire consequences for patients who get enrolled into a health plan that doesn't have many providers or hospitals in its network, Smith says. Patients were expected to sign up for one of the five plans online, but about 15% did. Everyone else was automatically enrolled into one of them. Richard says that figure isn't consistent with what other states across the country saw with the auto-enrollment process. And patients were assigned to the plan that had their primary care provider in network. But we also note that people may have another reason to be in a health plan, like a specialty provider that's really important to them, Richard says. So if they got assigned to a plan where that specialty provider's not there, they have the ability to change until September 30. After that 90-day period, patients can change their plans if they provide a reason, and they will have the option to change every year when their Medicaid eligibility comes up again, he says. For the first 60 days, providers will also still receive reimbursement if patients go to a provider that isn't in their health plan's network, Richard says. Added costs to providers. Even if a provider did secure contracts with all five health plans, the contracts have a significant number of rules and clinical policies that have to be followed that are more complex than what Medicaid traditionally had. If we were to sign agreements with all five of these plans, we would have to adhere to 1,300 new clinical policies, Carrico says. So the amount of complexity that comes with this, it's fairly daunting. The health system has already dealt with managed care organizations in the commercial market, so it has the skill set to deal with that complexity, Carrico says. However, the problem rests in the added administrative costs that will now accompany caring for Medicaid patients. Reimbursements are also expected to take a hit. UNC Health CFO Will Bryant told the health system's Board of Trustees in May that the transition to managed Medicaid was expected to lead to a roughly 3% decrease in payments, while patient volumes were expected to remain the same. The reason for that is because one of the tactics that these for-profit companies that are coming in to manage this Medicaid population use is they're much more stringent and difficult to work with from an approvals and a prior authorization standpoint, Bryant said. That will equate to a loss for UNC of $10 million to $15 million for the upcoming fiscal year. The other healthcare systems in the Triangle say they are expecting similar impacts to their budgets. We should expect probably a 10 to 15% decrease in our overall reimbursements from Medicaid, Carrico says. And the main reason for that are the complexities of billing and the denials. Denials can happen for a variety of reasons, Smith says, such as records not matching or a patient staying in the hospital for 96 hours instead of the authorized 72. How the state plans to address issues. Other states have seen mixed results when it comes to how managed Medicaid has impacted quality of care and cost, but there have been some prominent examples of fraud and abuse in the system. Data obtained and analyzed by Kaiser Health News in 2017 found the California's Medicaid insurers made $5.4 billion in profits between 2014 and 2016. According to an analysis of insurance filings by consulting firm Health Management Associates around the same time, insurers made more than $1 billion in 34 states and the District of Columbia, ranging from $1.1 billion in 2013 to $3.9 billion in 2015. Profit margins were around 2.4% at 2015, which represented a four-year high, but dropped to 0.7% in 2016 and to 0.5% in 2018, according to a 2019 analysis by the firm. Net underwriting profit in the 34 states in Washington, D.C. in 2018 was $911 million. Last month, Centene Corporation also agreed to pay $88.3 million to the state of Ohio to settle a lawsuit alleging the company overbilled the Ohio Department of Medicaid for the pharmacy services it provided. Richard says that because North Carolina is one of the last states to implement managed Medicaid, it was able to learn from what other states did and didn't do well and work that into its own system. For instance, there's a cap on how much the insurers can spend on administrative costs and requires about 88% of the funds they receive to go directly toward providing services for beneficiaries. In other states, however, insurers have sometimes failed to hit the established threshold for expenditures on services. Those companies are still accountable to the state of North Carolina, Richard says, and the state has the ability to penalize the insurers who don't meet the standards laid out in their contracts with the state. Ken Lewis, the outgoing executive director for the North Carolina Association of Health Plans, also provided a statement that also reiterates that the insurers are being held to a higher standard by the state. There are numerous financial safeguards and assurances for providers, access requirements, and rigorous service level agreements in place, Lewis says. Each plan must provide prompt payment to providers and convenient access to care. Both federal and state regulators have closely monitored the preparations for each health plan, none of which would be permitted to go live on July 1 if the regulatory standards were not met or exceeded. Skepticism lingers. Providers aren't entirely convinced. The state already made this transition when dealing with behavioral health through the formation of local management entities, or LMEs, Smith says. They were essentially quasi-governmental private companies that were given capitation to take care of behavioral health care, he says. It went pretty much as you could predict, Smith says. All of a sudden, you couldn't get authorizations for care. You couldn't get paid for things that you actually delivered, whether you had an authorization or not. Pretty soon, providers stopped taking care of Medicaid patients with behavioral health concerns, and the consequences are still creating problems, he says. Almost every day, we have a claim that's clearly a mental health claim, but the LME says, no, we don't pay that. That goes to the physical health side, Smith says. And they point at the state, and the state says, it's the mental health side. You should pay it. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to our continuing series, The Promise Of, the headline, Working Toward Iconic Status. Janelle Cato expanded her beauty supply biz to a storefront and outpaced her first week sales target eightfold. Story by Connie Gentry. About this project, the project name is based on a historical reference relating to Union Army leader William Sherman's promise of giving 40 acres to slaves after the Civil War. That promise, which came to be known as 40 acres and a mule, never came through as President Andrew Johnson rescinded the order after taking office. When the Icon Beauty Supply store opened in Briar Creek last month, owner Janelle Cato forecast first week sales at $3,000, in part based on what she had been producing since starting Icon as an e-commerce-only retail venture in August 2020, but also based on the advice of another beauty retailer. The number was off. By more than a little, sales that first week rang in at $24,000, and the momentum hasn't slowed. I asked my mentor how much I should expect to make the first week, and she suggested $3,000. She has a beauty supply store in Maryland and made $10,000 her first month in business, Cato says. Cato credits many things for Icon's over-the-top debut, including a social media influencer event that was held prior to the public grand opening. The social media event was like a VIP shopping party. I invited influencers to visit the store, and they got 20% off their purchase for posting about Icon. One of the girls who posted on Twitter was just getting started as an influencer, but her tweet had something like 1,700 retweets, and it went viral. Then a company with 134,000 followers on Instagram posted, and from there, people were tagging us and coming in. It has been great, Cato says. An accounting degree, plus an MBA, along with her full-time job working for the U.S. Army as a management analyst, helped ready Cato to run a retail business, but she has been surprised by how quickly sales took off at her brick-and-mortar store and how just as quickly sales went dark for her online business. I have no idea why, but my online sales went to zero when I opened the store, Cato explains. The first online sale since opening the Briar Creek shop occurred on June 18, almost 2 weeks after the new store opened. I'm not hurting and I'm not worried because sales at the store are going so well. A lot of beauty supply stores don't have an online store, so I'm going to use my store to drive traffic online. The store receipts have a blurb, shop online 24/7, and we're going to use social media to push online as well. In the 10 months she ran Icon as an e-commerce-only business, sales sometimes ran $3,000 a week, and sometimes it was closer to $3,000 or $4,000 a month. Since her retail operations have been open less than a year, she declined to quote a total revenue figure. Many of the e-commerce customers were out of state, whereas the Briar Creek shoppers are coming from the immediate area and within the Triangle. The reception to her beauty business storefront reflects trends across the retail industry, where sales have exceeded projections in recent months as consumers increasingly return to stores. In the July Economic Review from the National Retail Federation, Chief Economist Jack Kleinhans noted, "It has become clear that the U.S. economy and retail sales are growing far faster and more steadily than anyone could have expected just a few months ago. We are seeing not just unprecedented growth from months of pent-up demand as the economy reopens, but momentum as well. In the first 5 months of this year, retail sales were 17.6% above the same period in 2020, prompting NRF to revise its forecast for 2021 retail sales growth to reflect a year-over-year increase of 10.5% to 13.5%, with industry-wide annual sales projected for a range of $4.44 trillion to $4.56 trillion. Cato, purposely located in Briar Creek because the shopping centers are retail destinations that promote high-density traffic. There's not another beauty supply store within a 20-minute drive, so I want Icon to appeal to everyone, definitely to people of different races. We do have a section of products from black-owned businesses, but we also have Caucasian hair products and products for men and women," she says, adding that her clientele is 60% female and 40% male. "Men are taking better care of themselves and spending on skincare, and beards are a huge thing. Men are serious about getting what they need for those beards." The global beard grooming market is expected to reach $43.1 billion by 2026, up from $24.1 billion in 2018, according to reports from Global Newswire and MarketWatch. The global men's personal care market, valued at $47.5 billion in 2019, is forecast to reach $75.8 billion by 2027. A BodyLogic survey conducted in January found that 62% of American men are sporting facial hair and short stubble, the most popular choice, followed by full beards. Hair products are what has sold the most, Cato notes. Wigs, hair color, and natural hair care products have been really popular. About 20% of our products are for kids. Parents of mixed-race children need help figuring out what products to use, and men come in wanting to know what to do with their daughter's hair. While beauty is a business that sells, getting started wasn't easy for Cato. For starters, she had trouble finding a space that she could rent, largely because of financing challenges. "People prefer to buy beauty products in person rather than online because they want to see the consistency, run their fingers through it, and smell the fragrance. But online was all I could afford to do in the beginning," she says. "Online was my vehicle to get to the storefront. My e-commerce business was 100% self-financed. I was surprised my online business did so well, and then I got a personal loan from SoFi, Social Finance Incorporated, and business funding from First National Bank." A single mom with three children, Cato continues to work her full-time job with the Army and manages Icon in the hours before and after her day job. She credits the efficiency and loyalty of her staff for keeping the day-to-day operations running smoothly. Her next goal is to evolve Icon into a franchise model, and she's looking to her home state of Oklahoma as a potential site for the first franchise, which she envisions doing with her brother as a partner. She's also contemplating a second Triangle location, possibly in Cary or Fuquay Varina. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. Gardener leaves legacy in Clayton. In 2010, master gardener Roy Lewis started a community garden in the town of Clayton in a 100 by 100-foot space. In 2020, the Clayton Community Garden produced 5,751 pounds of fruit and vegetables that were donated to the Clayton Area Ministries Food Bank. And this year, its gardeners are expecting to produce 7,000 pounds or 3.5 tons of food for donations, the town says. Lewis passed away in April 2020, but the fruits of his labor have now grown to a garden that is triple the size of the original concept. He taught classes, advocated for the garden, and expanded this project to its current state. Master gardeners have continued his legacy, and volunteers are currently constructing a memorial within the garden to honor Lewis. I am so proud of what the Johnston County Master Gardener volunteers have been able to accomplish toward Roy's vision for the Clayton Community Garden, said Master Gardener Felice Chadwick. The garden is sustained entirely through volunteer efforts and grants courtesy of Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina. Gardeners must volunteer for 80 hours, but most people go far above that requirement. And on August 8th, from 9 a.m. to noon, the Johnston County Master Gardeners are offering a Gardening 101 workshop. SAS enters interesting phase. Wonder what was going through the minds of some 5,000 people at Cary SAS when the Wall Street Journal did a piece on tech giant Broadcom, with $24 billion in revenue, was interested in buying SAS. Of course, local media, including TBJ, picked up on the story and ran with it, but not 24 hours later, SAS founder James Goodnight released a statement emphatically stating SAS is not up for sale. But some SAS employees are left wondering if the company is talking to other companies about a possible buyout. It still looks like one of Triangle's most visible and relevant companies is open to discussions. Unless, of course, Goodnight is saying that talks with Broadcom never happened, but he didn't say that. Biz thinks this story is far from dead. It will be curious if some big announcement relating to leadership, partnership, or even contracts are soon made public, coming straight from Cary headquarters. Airbnb list praises North Carolina Park. Airbnb is out with its top trending destinations for summer 2021, and a North Carolina spot landed on its top 10 wish list of nature destinations in the U.S. The Great Dismal Swamp, located in South Mills in the northeastern part of the state, features 20 miles of trails beyond a 2,000-foot boardwalk that puts visitors in the midst of the swamp. The landscape has been witness to American Indian hunting parties, exploration by George Washington, and the story of the Underground Railroad, according to the North Carolina Parks and Recreation website. Bandwidth taps new finance chief. Raleigh-based Bandwidth has tapped a seasoned Texas executive to replace its departing CFO, Jeff Hoffman. Daryl Rayford, a veteran of firms such as MediaKind, Ribbon Communications, and Freescale Semiconductor, will start July 12th. With an initial base salary of $425,000, not including awards and bonuses, such as a target incentive amount worth 75% of that salary, and restricted stock units worth $2.5 million. Hoffman will stay on through August 31 to assist with the transition. NBA Finals have Tar Heel undertones. Regardless of the outcome of the 2021 NBA Finals, one championship ring will have a Carolina blue feel to it. Former UNC Chapel Hill standouts Cameron Johnson, a small forward for the Phoenix Suns, and Justin Jackson, a small forward for the Milwaukee Bucks, are vying for the title. That means that either Johnson or Jackson will be the 18th former UNC player to win an NBA championship, according to 24/7 Sports. Through the first three games of the finals, Johnson scored 32 points in a total of 69 minutes played. Jackson did not see action in those games. The last Carolina player to win a ring was Danny Green, who won his third NBA title last season with the Los Angeles Lakers. NCSU develops mosquito-resistant clothing. Researchers at NC State University have developed new clothes that are resistant to mosquito bites. Andrew West, Associate Professor of Textiles and Fashion, Mike Rowe, Professor of Entomology, and Run Luan, a postdoctoral researcher, found the clothes prevented 100% of bites in experiments with live mosquitoes and believe they can be used to prevent disease transmission. NC State startup Vector Textiles has licensed the rights to the patents and intends to commercialize the clothing in the U.S. And finally, New Pup joins Pack. The NC State University Wolfpack is now one stronger. The school recently introduced Tuffy 3 to the community. The puppy is the third Tamaskan dog to serve as the school's live mascot in games. Avid NC State fans and New Bern residents Joe and Lisa Downey have bred and raised all three Tuffies. Tuffy the third is a direct descendant of Tuffy the first and takes the place of Tuffy the second, who died unexpectedly last October. Lisa Downey said creating a direct line between Tuffy 1 and future Tuffies was important, and that's why the family put Tuffy 1 on ice years ago. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Airports and Legal page, written by Lauren Onisorge. Lawsuit, NC College misled aspiring pilots. The difference between taking to the skies and delivering pizza comes down to 500 flight hours. At least that's the situation a group of would-be pilots say they're in, and they're blaming Craven Community College, a rural school that's made a reputation for itself as a cost-effective way to respond to a years-long pilot shortage. Eight former students with aspirations of being pilots have filed a federal lawsuit naming the trustees of Craven Community College and its partner flight school, Tradewinds Flight Services, as two of the defendants. The lawsuit accuses the school and its administrators of making false statements and targeting veterans, selling a program that, according to the allegations, they couldn't really deliver on, and crushing career prospects in the process. The school has declined to comment on the case. But the students are talking, saying the problems at the school are bigger than certifications. They've also accused the school of serious safety issues and say that instead of addressing their concerns, Craven pushed back. It's a conflict with wide-reaching applications, as the aviation program isn't just a point of pride for Craven County, but for the whole state, as North Carolina continues to try to retain veterans coming out of nearby Camp Lejeune and other bases. Add in a growing need for pilots. The U.S. enforces a mandatory retirement age of 65 for commercial pilots, and a silver wave is coming, and the school is helping to fill a national need. The case is currently in North Carolina's Eastern District, and plaintiffs say their careers could be riding on the outcome. Craven Community College, which has just partnered with the flight school, Tradewinds Flight Services, sold the program as a cost-effective chance to fly, the lawsuit claims. In response to a nationwide pilot shortage, Craven had come up with what appeared at the time, a way to prepare pilots for a certification with only 1,250 post-degree flight hours. The five-semester Aviation Management and Career Pilot Technology program, however, did never have the accreditation to deliver on that promise, the lawsuit claims, leaving plaintiffs in the lurch after months and in some cases years of training. Russian national sentenced in Raleigh case. A pair of Russian nationals turned Raleigh real estate investors have been sentenced following guilty pleas in what prosecutors initially described as a long-running kickback scheme. Leonid Teff was sentenced to 5 years in prison on July 9, after which he will be deported to either Belarus, Israel, or Russia, according to court documents. Tatiana Teff, his wife, was sentenced to time served. In an email, Leonid Teff's attorney, Robert Wolf, called the outcome a tremendous victory for his client, as it comes with the release of certain assets, including a multi-million-dollar home in Raleigh's Northridge community. Mr. Teff won the dismissal of all 37 money laundering charges, dismissal of the murder-for-hire charge, and the dismissal of most of the other charges against him, all of which comprise the government's main case against him, Wolf said in an email. Mr. Teff also won the return of the vast majority of his previously seized assets, which will now be returned to him by the government. The government also withdrew their claims against Mr. Teff's numerous real estate properties, and all of those will be returned. With credit for time already served, Mr. Teff only has approximately 18 months left to complete his sentence. The sentencing was in federal court in New Bern. Initially, the Teffs had faced a slew of charges. Leonid Teff had even been handed the murder-for-hire count by prosecutors. But in return for the guilty plea, prosecutors agreed to drop most of the charges, including murder-for-hire and money laundering. Leonid Teff eventually pleaded guilty to just bribery of a public official, visa fraud, and providing false statements on a tax return. His wife pleaded guilty to making a false statement in an immigration matter. All other charges were dismissed following the plea deal. Their case, which initially involved accusations of $150 million in kickback payments from the Russian government, has attracted a lot of attention in Raleigh, as prior to the 2018 indictment, the couple had been steadily building a real estate portfolio in the region. An FBI raid in 2018, however, suspended those ambitions. RDU nearly landed two European flights, then COVID struck. Just 2 years ago, airport officials were in the midst of meaningful conversations about adding to Raleigh-Durham International Airport's international destinations list. Raleigh-Durham Airport Authority CEO Mike Langeth confirms, but COVID completely stifled those conversations, potentially for years. Publicly, Langeth was trying to set the groundwork for a someday nonstop to China, speaking at business events and lobbying area business executives to support the lofty goal. But privately, he was working to secure flights with a quicker timetable. Langeth confirmed conversations were advancing about RDU nonstops to both Amsterdam and Frankfurt. From his perspective, RDU was close to literally doubling its European destination list, and accordingly, his team was working to expand RDU's international gate capacity. And then came COVID. In March of 2020, we literally hit a wall, Langeth said. 65% of all commercial service airports in the world were grounded at the same time. That takes the demand out. RDU switched from negotiating to recovering. In talks with airlines, this looks like a 2022 recovery for international, he said. At RDU, it could take much longer to get back to those meaningful conversations. And in a section called By the Numbers, in the months since Apple and Google announced thousands of jobs in the Triangle, the state has actually secured more attention from companies looking to relocate or expand their organizations in the state. Chris Chung, CEO for the state's top recruitment engine, the Economic Development Partnership of North Carolina, said that as of July 1, his team was working on 207 total recruitment and expansion projects, representing a potential of nearly 71,000 jobs and $47 billion in new investment. The state began June with 184 projects, adding up to 69,000 potential jobs, and more than $43 billion is in possible investment. And finally, a big number, 50. Raleigh's CapTrust Financial Advisors announced the closure of another deal this month, the acquisition of Nachman, Norwood & Parrott in Greenville, South Carolina. The move adds more than $2.1 billion in assets under management, as well as a new stronghold in South Carolina. The deal marks the 50th buyout for the Raleigh wealth management firm. It's kind of cool, right? CEO Fielding Miller said. We're about to hit 1,000 employees. That's also a fun metric. And now we turn to the On Real Estate section, written by Caleb Harshberger. The main headline, Eli Lilly adds to its RTP land. Eli Lilly snags 102 acres, plans expansion. Pharmaceutical giant Eli Lilly expanded its holdings in the Research Triangle Park yet again last month with the purchase of a 102-acre assemblage as work continues on its new campus in the park. The company paid $33.16 million for 102 acres across three disjointed parcels in RTP next to its current holdings and upcoming pharmaceutical manufacturing facility in the park. The land is situated at 45 and 51 Moore Drive and 2242 Northeast Creek Parkway. The seller is Los Angeles-based Carlin Real Estate, which built up a massive assemblage in the park over the years and has been selling it in pieces to companies such as Eli Lilly and Alexandria Real Estate Equities. This latest deal sits next to the site of Eli Lilly's upcoming manufacturing facility as part of a major expansion in the region. We have purchased additional land immediately adjacent to our site under construction, Eli Lilly said in a statement. This land purchase further emphasizes our commitment to RTP and allows for future expansion opportunity. Last year, Eli Lilly announced it picked Durham County for a $474 million expansion to construct a new manufacturing facility that will bring more than 460 jobs to the region. The new facility will provide drug formulation and packaging for two diabetes treatments, the well-known injectable Trulicity, and the in-development Tirzepatide, which is for patients who have an increased risk of heart disease. Work on that facility is currently underway. Our Lilly RTP site construction is progressing on schedule, and we are currently recruiting for staff, including engineers, scientists, and other professional positions, the company said. We're beginning the interior fit-out work on several buildings in preparation for the first manufacturing equipment to arrive at year-end. The site will be brought online in phases, with the first phase expected to be operational by 2023, pending regulatory approval, he says. The company bought its initial 110 acres in the park for $36 million last year. Pair of 40-story rezoning efforts. A pair of recently approved rezoning efforts could spell major changes for downtown Raleigh's warehouse district after city council voted to rezone a pair of properties for up to 40 stories of development. On July 6th, the Raleigh City Council approved two rezoning requests, one by Highwoods Properties and the other by City Plat, to allow for up to 40 stories of mixed-use developments at assemblages on the northeast and southeast corners of Harrington and Hargett Streets. Both developers are based in Raleigh and neither have unveiled plans for the future developments. Highwoods Properties filed the rezoning for 327 and 321 West Hargett Street and 213 South Harrington Street last October, calling for up to 439,839 square feet of office, up to 700 residential units, and 20,584 square feet of retail. Council members voted 6-1 to approve the new zoning for the for that project, with Councilman David Cox voting no. City Plat refiled a rezoning request for the Legends nightclub property at 330 West Hargett and 119 South Harrington Streets in January, calling for up to 246,713 square feet of office, 416 residential units, and 11,952 square feet of retail. City Plat bought the property for $4.3 million in November with an agreement to lease space to the Legends nightclub for the time being. Council members are voting, also voted unanimously to approve new zoning for that project. Apartments sell for $71 million. A Massachusetts investor picked up a Morrisville apartment community last week, just a year after the community opened in 2020. On July 9, Boston-based TA Realty paid $71 million for the 263-unit Broadstone Trailside apartments in Morrisville, or $269,961 per unit. The property is situated at 5860 McCrimmon Parkway. Defunct Chapel Hill Hotel to get major redevelopment. Last year, plans for a massive redevelopment of the University Inn in Chapel Hill fell into doubt after the developers pulled out of the project amid the pandemic. Now a new group has stepped up to claim the site and last week closed on that land. Houston developer the Dinnerstein Companies is making its entrance into North Carolina with a $10.6 million acquisition of the University Hill Inn. With plans for a mixed-use development on the site, the property is situated on 3.9 acres at 1301 Fordham Boulevard. And finally, we have a big number, $20.5 million. The price paid earlier this month by New York investor DRA Advisors for an industrial building at 2910 Weck Drive in Durham. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Retail and Restaurants page written by Erica Wells. Chef enters delivery business. Raleigh Chef's Cuisine reaches the Northwest with ghost kitchens. A Raleigh chef has entered the high-end food delivery market after pivoting during the pandemic to expand beyond North Carolina for the first time. Crawford & Son owner Scott Crawford created Crawford Cook Shop to offer food that can be enjoyed at home after indoor dining was temporarily suspended last year. In June, Crawford Cook Shop was made available through the Crave delivery platform in Boise, Idaho, where Crave Hospitality Group co-founder and chef Scott Howard created the startup and set up a ghost kitchen, a place where food is prepared just for delivery without dining space. The facility, which opened last fall, also features offerings from other chefs and restaurateurs from around the country, including Tony G's Pizza by Tony Gemnani, Mac and Q by International Smoke from Michael Mina, and Aisha Curry. It's an incredibly fun and exciting thing that happened because of circumstances that we couldn't control, Crawford says. We made something very positive that was very negative. I love that it was created that way. It's a philosophy that we work with in this industry. It's a tough industry with a lot of challenges, but we always turn those challenges into something positive. Crawford, a five-time James Beard Award nominee, developed the idea after coming up with curbside options at the Raleigh restaurant when Howard approached him. Last summer, Crawford started Crawford Cook Shop as a three-month pop-up in the Boise market. Crawford also plans to open a full-service version in Clayton with a casual experience and indoor and outdoor seating, a U-shaped bar, and full menu available for delivery later this year. It will employ 15. He opened Crawford & Son in 2016 and Jolie, a French bistro named after his daughter, in 2019. For years, his guests have been requesting delivery service, but he resisted until he found the right partnership, he says. Crawford also announced plans to open Crawford Brothers Steakhouse in Fenton in Cary in 2022. Labor shortage threatens Durham's restaurant hospitality sectors. Many food services and hospitality businesses in Durham are at the point where they need to make hires in unfilled positions as soon as possible or risk closing. More than 70% of local businesses have been impacted by the ongoing labor shortage, according to a survey led by Discover Durham, which leads tourism efforts for the city. More than 60% said the labor shortage posed an extreme threat to their company's viability. The agency collaborated with Durham Technical Community College, North Carolina Central University, and the city's Office of Economic and Workforce Development to find out what the businesses needed to stay open. The survey found that, on average, each business is trying to fill around 19 positions. In North Carolina, the leisure and hospitality services sector saw the largest over-the-year decrease in jobs, with a loss of 87,200 positions from January 2020 to January 2021, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. As a result, many businesses have tried to win back workers by offering higher wages and benefits, focusing on diversity and inclusion, and promoting a healthy work environment, said Discover Raleigh President and CEO Susan Amy. Developer to expand Raleigh's Quail's Corner Shopping Center. A Triangle developer has plans to expand a retail space in Raleigh. East Millbrook LLC has filed a rezoning request with the city to add 33,488 square feet of shopping space near Quail Corner Shopping Center at 1200 and 1204 Millbrook Road, according to the application. The shopping center has been unofficially named Quail's Corners East Millbrook, said Steve Young, partner with Heritage Remodel and Design in Raleigh. The project will include a two-story building with about 16,000 square foot on each level and 138 parking spaces, Young said. The top floor will feature office space, while the ground floor will have restaurants and retailers. The 2.87-acre site is zoned for single-family use but would require a mixed-use designation. And in a section called She Said It, a quote from Kim Hammer, owner of Bittersweet in Raleigh, on the Restaurant Revitalization Fund's awards being rescinded. The U.S. Small Business Administration needs to honor the people who received approval. We did everything we were supposed to do. They need to give us that money so we can go back to work. And finally, a big number, $32.5 billion. That's the amount parents in the U.S. are expected to spend for back-to-school shopping for K-12 students, according to Deloitte's back-to-school survey, as reported in Retail Drive. And now we turn to the On Life Sciences page, written by Sonia Warwick. Spinout goes big with raise. Durham biotech company raises $70 million. A Duke University spinout has raised $70 million to further develop its technology to predict therapeutic responses in cancer patients and aid drug development. Xilis Incorporated, that's spelled X-I-L-I-S, Xilis Incorporated's microorganosphere technology generates thousands of miniature tumors derived from patients that can be analyzed in their own microenvironment. The funding will help the company advance that technology further, expand its AI capabilities, fund clinical studies, and validate the technology with partners in the biopharmaceutical industry. The Series A round was led by Mubadala Capital and joined by new investors GV, formerly Google Ventures, European investment firm Life Science Partners, Catalio Capital Management, and Duke Angel Network. Others who previously invested in the company: Felicis Ventures, Two Sigma Ventures, Peer VC, KDT Ventures, and Alex Ventures also participated in the round. Our vision is to transform cancer care and diagnostics and reshape drug development by providing a technology for rapid profiling, Xiling Shen, co-founder and CEO of Xilis, said in a statement. The support provided by these world-class investors is an important milestone in our journey to transform cancer care and dramatically improve patient survival by enabling personalized precision oncology and bringing transformative medicines to patients faster and with higher success rates. The company was founded in 2019 by Shen and David Hsu, professors at Duke University, alongside Hans Cleaver, who invented the organoid technology and is a partner at LSP. Since my lab invented organoids a dozen years ago, we provided a proof of concept for many applications. Yet the technology remains slow, complex, and expensive, Clever said in a statement. Together with LSP, I've been looking for enabling technology to unlock the full potential, and Dr. Shen and Dr. Su's invention of the MOS, M-O-S technology has torn down those hurdles and will accelerate its use both in the clinic and for drug discovery and development, Clevers added. In addition to predicting therapeutic responses, which takes less than 2 weeks from patient biopsy, the platform can also be used at multiple stages of research and development for drugs such as preclinical toxicity and efficacy and bioanalytical testing. Inceptor Bio launches first portfolio company out of UNC. A triangle firm that's seeking to build a portfolio of cell and gene therapy companies focused on curing cancer has announced its first investment. Inceptor Bio has launched a company called Fastback Bio with new technology licensed from UNC Chapel Hill to develop CAR-T, or chimeric antigen receptor T-cell, therapies to treat solid tumors. CAR-T therapies harness an individual's own immune system to target cancerous cells by modifying the body's T-cells with chimeric antigen receptors that allow it to recognize and attack tumor cells. The technology was licensed from the UNC lab of Lishan Su, who will continue supporting the development of the M83 platform through sponsored research and serve as an advisor to Fastback Bio. Through the sponsored research agreements, we're counting on the universities to do what they do best, says Mike Nicholson, chief scientific officer at Inceptor Bio. They have models available that we don't. They have protocols that they've worked out, he adds. Carey Company lands partnership. A medical technology giant has entered into an agreement to resell a Carey Company's device that detects if radioactive injections from PET or CT scans have mistakenly entered a patient's soft tissue. Lucerno Dynamics entered into an agreement with Siemens Healthineers, headquartered in Germany, to resell Lucerno's Lara system in the U.S. In PET or CT scans, patients are injected with radioactive materials meant to accumulate at areas in the body that may have problems in order to allow them to be seen in images. The Lara system allows clinicians to detect when radioactive material is injected into soft tissue instead of the vein. When the material is prevented from reaching problem areas, it can result in inaccurate images. And in a section called She Said It, a quote from Peyton Howell, chief commercial and strategy officer at Parexel, after the announcement that Goldman Sachs and EQT Private Equity bought the contract research organization from Pamplona Capital Management for $8.5 billion. Our work in COVID-19, including some of the most important COVID-19 therapeutics, has helped transform our business. The level of innovation, the pace of work, the way that we've been able to adapt clinical trials has been transformed by the urgency that the pandemic has created. And finally, a big number, $1.85 billion. That's how much Milken Institute School of Public Health researchers found the Triangle, Wake, Durham, Orange, Franklin, Orange, and Johnston counties, would see in a new business activity if Medicaid were expanded in the state. And now we turn to On Orange County, written by Rachel Crumpler. Durham Eatery opens new spot. Popular chicken and waffles restaurant expands to Chapel Hill. Two business partners are making progress on a vision for their chicken and waffles restaurant to expand across the state and ultimately across state lines. The newest location of Dame's Chicken and Waffles opened at 147 East Franklin Street, the former location of Ski's Restaurant, in May. It is the fourth franchise location. We knew when we built our first one it wouldn't be our last one, co-founder Damian Dame Moore says. Moore and Randy Wadsworth, who attended business school together at UNC Greensboro, opened the first Dame's Chicken and Waffles in 2010 in Durham. The other restaurants are located in Greensboro and Cary. We try to find locations that are high foot traffic areas, great visibility, relatively easily accessible, and have some amenities to offer to our guests like parking and outdoor dining, Moore says. Dame's Chicken and Waffles has implemented a new express service model at the Chapel Hill location. Instead of having a sit-down restaurant with a full wait staff like the three other locations, Chapel Hill has counter service. Moore says this model will require less staff and allow for a quicker turnaround time. This service model also requires less square footage. The Chapel Hill location is about 2,000 square feet, while each of the other three locations are upwards of 3,000 square feet. They will remain sit-down restaurants, but as more locations open in the coming years, Moore says he believes there will be more demand for the express model. Moore says he and his business partner are always looking for new opportunities, though no firm plans have been made for the next location. Places of interest include Charlotte, Fayetteville, Wilmington, and Jacksonville, he says. Once Dame's Chicken and Waffles capitalizes on additional markets in the state in the next few years, Moore says the company will be in a position to expand across state lines. We're trying to grow naturally, not overwhelm ourselves, but still be in a position to capitalize in areas where we have high demand for our product, Moore says. Chapel Hill has a plan. For decades, the town of Chapel Hill has been skeptical of growth and the change that comes with it, but as the town emerges from the pandemic, it's making a concerted effort to attract new businesses, retain its local talent, and invest in local minority-owned businesses. Roughly half the jobs in Chapel Hill are tied to education or healthcare, and the goal is to make the town more attractive, in particular to tech startups and life sciences companies, the types of firms fueling much of the Triangle's growth. The town's Revive Chapel Hill plan is intended to position Chapel Hill as a center for research and development, laying a foundation for long-term economic success and transformation. I would like to believe that a year from now we're in a completely different place and we're not struggling the way we are now, that businesses aren't struggling trying to find employees, that businesses feel better about their financial health, and we've helped bring some traffic to Chapel Hill, Bassett says. The town council has allocated $650,000 in American Rescue Plan funds to the economic recovery plan. Carrboro envisions economic future. John Hartman Brown only just moved to Carrboro and assumed the role of the town's economic development director last July. But he has found the Carrboro economy to be quite resilient and says the town is on a positive recovery trajectory. People are really seeing this early post-pandemic period, this recovery time, as an opportunity, Hartman Brown says. He is receiving, on average, at least two business inquiries each week from people interested in talking about starting a new business or seeking available space. And with COVID starting to recede, Hartman Brown is focused on charting a vision for the long-term future of Carrboro, one that will include bringing tech startups into the town's small business mix, which has long been dominated by retail and restaurants. And in a section called He Said It, a quote from Jonathan Jensen, an assistant professor of sport administration at UNC Chapel Hill, who has experience negotiating sponsorship deals between companies and athletes on the complications of college athletes cashing in on their personal brand under the new NCAA rules enacted July 1. I'm worried that a degree that's worth between $1 million and $1.5 million over their lifetime could get jeopardized because instead of taking a quiz or a test, they're posting on TikTok and getting $100 for it. And finally, in a big number, 240. That's how many employers are certified by Orange County Living Wage, a nonprofit organization, as paying employees at least a $15.40 an hour living wage. Since the onset of the pandemic, an additional 41 employers have become certified, many from the food and beverage industry. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to some of our general news stories, starting with a story written by Caleb Harshberger and Lauren Onasorge. Sources: Google eyes ATC for engineering hub, where Google could call home in downtown Durham. As Google moves ahead with plans for a massive hub in Durham, multiple sources say the tech giant is eyeing the upcoming American Tobacco campus expansion for its permanent home in the Triangle. In March, Google announced plans to bring a massive engineering hub to the city with the potential for 1,000 jobs. The company signed on to sublease space from Duke University at 200 Moore Street, but at the time did not comment on its plans for a permanent location. In the months since, multiple sources have confirmed that the company has its eyes set on the future American Tobacco campus expansion, currently slated for the site of the former University Ford auto dealership in downtown Durham. The property is owned by Capital Broadcasting Company, which released plans for the development last summer. Sources say talks between Google and CBC are still ongoing. In response to requests for comment, a Google spokesperson released a statement saying, Google has not made a final decision on its permanent location for the Durham Cloud Hub. CBC declined to comment for this story. Google's interest in the property would be in line with the city's expectations for the company. Documents released by the city of Durham through a public records request show Google was searching for a larger facility, which, according to communications from Durham Mayor Steve Shule, will need at least 100,000 square feet and in the future significantly more. The California-based company would like to be downtown, he wrote in an email, adding that it's his hope that Google's engineering hub will be a tenant in one of the towers going up in downtown Durham in the coming years. And we'll stop there as the rest of the article goes on to give some of the backstory of what we've been hearing about the Google move coming up. CCX Modal Terminal set to open in 4Q. $160 million rail facility in Rocky Mount could be a game changer. This is written by Evan Hoopfer. A long-awaited project in Rocky Mount that could serve as an economic engine for the region is scheduled to come online later this year. The Carolina Connector, or CCX, Intermodal Terminal, operated by rail giant CSX, is slated to open in early fourth quarter, says Jason Orthner, Rail Division Director at the North Carolina Department of Transportation. It's pretty exciting, he says, and a real game changer for that area of North Carolina. CSX Corporation is one of the seven Class I railroads in North America that serve as the backbone of the continent's logistics industry. This facility, located in Edgecombe County, will serve as a vital link connecting rail cars and trucks so product can move around the state. CSX has approximately 30 intermodal terminals across its nearly 20,000-mile rail network, serving states east of the Mississippi River, according to the regulatory filings. The 330-acre site will have capacity for up to 110,000 container lifts per year, Orthner says, making it one of the largest rail facilities in the state. The terminal will ship a wide range of goods, everything from paper to agriculture products coming in and out of the Greater Triangle region. Previously, NCDOT said the facility could produce an estimated 1,300 indirect jobs. NCDOT is providing $118 million in funding, and CSX is contributing another $40 million. This will be the fourth Class I terminal in the state, joining two facilities in Charlotte area and another in the Greensboro area. And we've run out of time for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Triangle Business Journal is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. So long until next time, and thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.